Well, an activist in Omaha, Nebraska is asking a federal court to ban balloon releases at University of Nebraska football games. I imagine there are some number of Spartan football fans who, of course, have attended a game in Lincoln, right? Apparently, the Cornhuskers release all kinds of helium balloons whenever they score the first touchdown in a game. And this threat of a lawsuit is apparently the latest skirmish in a nationwide dispute over whether helium balloons exact a heavy toll on the environment. Randall Krause filed suit in U.S. District Court last week, alleging the release of thousands of bright red balloons by Cornhusker fans after the first touchdown of home games violates environmental laws. Mr. Krause likens the balloons to flying garbage that endangers wildlife and even children when they eventually fall back to earth. Nebraska has been releasing balloons at home games since the 1940s. It doesn't comment on pending legislation, according to Steve Smith, a spokesman. Quote, it is, however, worth noting that every balloon released in Memorial Stadium is natural latex biodegradable, and they're tied off with 100% cotton strings, he said in a statement. This all courtesy of Ben Kessling in today's Wall Street Journal. There is apparently an anti-balloon group, advocacy group, Balloons Blow, and they are part of this dispute. Current state here on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. Last week, former state legislator Gretchen Whitmer of East Lansing was chosen to be Ingham County prosecutor on an interim basis. A 7-member panel of county circuit judges appointed her unanimously to that post. Whitmer will assume the position on July 2nd. That's when prosecutor Stuart Dunnings III formally steps down. He faces various charges involving prostitution. For several years, Gretchen Whitmer's been discussed as a potential candidate for higher office here in Michigan, governor or maybe attorney general. Whitmer's been an attorney at legal firm Dickinson Wright since being term-limited out of the state Senate last year. On Friday, I spoke with Gretchen Whitmer about the prosecutor assignment. I first asked why she offered to serve in the position.
Well, you know, I spent 14 years representing Ingham County and some parts of Ingham County and almost all of it at one point. And I really think that people have lost faith in our public servants and in our government. What we've seen, the circumstances that led us to this point are just very disturbing and sad. And I thought, to the extent that the judges believed a real part of this job was trying to earn back the confidence of the people of Ingham County and to be transparent and to be a real advocate for victims, that's something that I think I've done over these 14 years and for the same community, and that I might be helpful. And if my skills were helpful, I hoped that they might put them to work. I think it's important, and I think public service is a privilege, but it's also extremely rewarding.
You first became a practicing attorney at Dickinson Wright, your current firm, back in 2000. How well do you understand the role of the county prosecutor and how the office works?
Well, your point about Dickinson Wright, they've been fantastic, and I'll just start with that. I'm very lucky to have had such a great opportunity with a statewide firm. I don't have much experience in criminal law per se, but the Office of the Prosecutor, the most important thing that we are doing is protecting victims and seeking justice and holding people accountable. And so the top person is the one that sets the tone, that ensures that people are conducting themselves in a professional manner with integrity and communicates with the public. And to the extent that that's what the job entails, I think it's a good match.
For our listeners who aren't necessarily well-versed in the mechanics of the prosecutor's office, though, can you explain it?
Sure. Well, so the county prosecutor's office is obviously the agency vested with the responsibility and authority to hold people who conduct, you know, who engage in criminal activity accountable. And we will oversee so many different types of cases across Ingham County that it's an enormous undertaking and enormous responsibility. Work critically and very closely with all law enforcement agencies. And I think it's run pretty well. I think that the reputation of the assistant prosecuting attorneys within the office is quite good. And so I anticipate that there will be a lot of work on the inside to do, because I do think that this circumstance has created a lot of, I don't know, maybe a hit to morale, if you will. And so I think that that's going to be very important. But my short-term goal is to make sure that we've got an open and honest relationship with all of the law enforcement agencies. I want to ask, what has the prosecutor's office done well, and where is there room for improvement? And that room for improvement is where I want to spend some energy. I also think that the victim advocacy is obviously paramount, and so I take that very seriously, and that will remain a priority. The long-term goal is to turn over a professional operation that runs well top to bottom to whomever wins the general election in November.
And how many people work in the prosecutor's office?
There's 62 employees, and at any given time, there's 4 to 8 interns.
And to what extent will you consider this a learning experience?
Well, I think, you know, people, you're supposed to evolve every day. You're supposed to learn every day. And anyone who thinks
That's the idea, right? Yeah.
Anyone who thinks they have all the answers is either arrogant or ignorant. I hope to learn a lot, frankly. I have already had a meeting with someone from the prosecutor's office, the chief assistant. Next week, Gene Rigglesworth has invited me to a meeting of all of the chiefs, and I will be getting an opportunity to meet with all of the assistant prosecuting attorneys. It's one of those things that I don't actually take office until July 2nd, but when I spoke with the chief judge, I asked her if it would be appropriate for me to reach out and try to start to get the lay of the land and get to know the people that are, you know, in the courtrooms doing the work. And she said she didn't see why not. And so I've started that process. And I'm, you know, I think that there's a lot to learn, of course.
Gretchen Whitmer joins me here on WKAR's Current State. As she just said, she begins serving as interim Ingham County prosecutor on Saturday, July 2nd. You were selected by a panel of circuit court judges, Baird, Lawless, Collette, Aquilina, Kennedy, Dragonchuk, JMO. Do those judges ever preside over cases that involve the county prosecutor's office?
Oh, yes, absolutely. They've got criminal cases in their courtrooms all the time.
Is there potential for conflict of interest? This crossed my mind. I mean, could those judges who selected you have business in the next few months with the prosecutor's office, though?
Well, the judges are, you know, the voters elected each of those judges, and they vote as a panel. This is an extremely unique situation that rarely arises, and so I think a lot of opinions had to be solicited in terms of how they are supposed to conduct replacing the prosecutor that has resigned. But, you know, all of these county officers, their jobs overlap, and I don't anticipate that there would ever be a question of their impartiality with regard to a criminal proceeding that is going on in their office. They certainly wouldn't have held any of the criminal prosecutions currently underway against anyone because of what's happened with our outgoing prosecutor, and they wouldn't I wouldn't ever question that their impartiality on anything going forward either.
I'd like a few minutes with you on state issues here. The Flint water crisis continues to grind away criminal charges, the relief effort, lawsuits, and on. As we sit here on May 13th, how do you assess the state's overall response to the Flint situation?
Well, I think it's so very sad what has happened in Flint. And every time I turn on my faucet, I think about what would happen if you couldn't, if the water that was coming out of there was hurting your kids in the bathtub and they had rashes, or they weren't growing right, or you've done long-term damage. I can't even get my head around how some of these parents and kids are dealing with the fallout from what's happened. There were so many red flags that came up over a period of time that the philosophy in the executive office of our state, in the governor's office, was to save money, and whether there was direct knowledge at the very top or not, that was the overarching philosophy, and they blew through so many red flags, missed so many different opportunities to stop and correct the problem, and I it's just really, you understand why people are losing faith in our government, and that's something that's very troubling to me.
But again, as we sit here on May 13th, what about all the efforts that are underway from the state? How do you assess those?
Well, I think that the fact that people still can't drink their water is mind-boggling. And it's wonderful to see all of these charitable organizations come together and make these massive contributions. But we should never rely on charitable contributions to supplant a core function that state government is supposed to provide. At the very minimum, government is supposed to protect us and protect the most vulnerable around and within our state, whether it's in law enforcement or it is in just the water quality. We're the Great Lakes State. We have a Pure Michigan campaign. We define ourselves and literally our state by water, defines who we are. And to be a late night punchline because we failed the people is not only horrifying for the people that live in Flint, but every one of us should be worried about that and concerned about it. These same people are the ones that are overseeing our water, the ones that are overseeing the dioxin plume in Washtenaw County. We've all paid a price because government failed this community, because we're all from Michigan and we all have a vested interest in the health of the people of our state, and as well as the reputation of this state, obviously.
Should the governor resign?
I've been asked that question a number of times, and I've never said he should resign, but I understand the sentiment of those who call on him to. I think that Brian Kelly as governor wouldn't be a major change that helps people. I mean, he's on the ground in Flint. He's supposedly working on this. So I've not called on the governor to resign. I think the person most interested in getting something done is the man who's going to worry about his legacy. But we're not seeing enough done quickly enough.
Are you expecting him to serve out his term then?
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
There are two Detroit public school rescue packages being debated at the Capitol. Do you actively support one plan over another?
There's no question the Senate plan is far superior to the House. The Senate plan was a bipartisan plan that I think the treasurer and actuaries and people that looked at the financial mechanisms in it say that really is a sustainable plan, one that makes sense. I think it's the only serious plan on the table. The bill that the House passed out at 4 o'clock in the morning last week was written by the charter lobby, and it's at the expense of Detroit school kids. The treasurer, you know, Governor Snyder's state treasurer, said that plan's not even financially viable, because by August they're back in a debt situation. So it came out on a party-line vote. It was written by the charter school lobby, and no, I don't think it's a serious plan at all. The only honest attempt to solve this is the attempt that came out of the Senate.
You're one of three Democrats that I hear mentioned regularly as possible candidates for governor in 2018. What's your thinking on that today?
Well, I think about the state of Michigan that I grew up in the 70s, and we were leaders on so many fronts. And I look at the state that my girls are growing up in, and sometimes it's hard to recognize. Like every parent around this state, I want my kids to stay in Michigan, to have opportunity here, to be respected and protected here in Michigan. And I know we can do a lot better. So that's how I look at the state of our state right now. And the thought that perhaps I could be a part of making sure that we're doing better and for our kids and to keep them here, that's something that I will continue to seriously consider.
Would you most seriously consider the top job, or are there other positions that you would also consider?
I think if you're going to take on the Herculean task of running for a statewide office, you should run for the one where you can do the most good for the most people. And so I am looking at governor.
Mm. How long do you think that process will likely take?
I would imagine, because knowing that our attorney general is going to be running for governor very likely and has been looking at and preparing for that for a long time, that it will be an intensive long-term campaign. And so I would imagine early next year.
You're a Hillary Clinton supporter. How would you describe the impact Bernie Sanders has had on the presidential campaign?
Well, you know, no one likes a primary. I'll just say that. But I think that oftentimes candidates are better off for having had a primary. And I certainly think that Bernie has electrified a segment of our population that might not otherwise have been engaged in this debate. And so I think that that's a good thing. I see the Republican side and the bizarre debates that they've had and lack of substance, and I'm proud to be a Democrat. But I do hope that the party comes together in short order around Hillary Clinton. I do think that her path is solid through the primary, and I think she's got a great shot to get elected this fall. But we've got to take Donald Trump very seriously. I mean, even though, in my estimation, he's not got a whole lot of substance that should be taken seriously, as a candidate and the enthusiasm around him from so many people in our country, he's got to be taken seriously. And if we want to move this country forward and make sure that all people are respected and that we are respected around the globe, then I think that we've got to really mobilize and make sure that we elect Hillary Clinton.
Does his candidacy concern you more today than it did, say, 6 months ago?
Well, it does. I think no one took him seriously when he first got into it. He's a reality television star who's made a lot of money in a lot of different ways, but the fact of the matter is he is not someone who is well-versed on international policy or homeland security or a variety of many, many other issues. You know, we used to have debates that were about ideas and philosophies, and they could be hard-hitting, but they were talking about issues that matter to people. We've seen name-calling and veiled remarks about, you know, how well-endowed a candidate is, and it's just so far beyond what we should expect of our leaders. We should expect substance and fire and excitement and ideas and philosophy and debates on issues. And we haven't seen that. And it's really very troubling. And I hope that the people across this country, finally, when we have two candidates who are facing off, zero in on how important that is.
If Hillary Clinton were elected, do you think Bernie Sanders' success will, to any extent, shape Hillary Clinton's agenda? Do you think he's had that much impact?
Absolutely. I think that we've had a more robust debate about things that are in the center of where Democrats, you know, the beauty of being a Democrat is we've got a huge tent and we've got so many people with different viewpoints, but I think that we've had a really great debate that brings people kind of to what the general person on the Democratic side of the aisle wants to hear people talking about, and that will continue on. It will dictate many of the issues going forward, and I think that's a good thing.
If she were sitting here right now, who would you recommend she choose as a running mate?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I think the HUD secretary, Julian Castro, would be a great choice. He's from Texas. He's Hispanic. He's dynamic and young, and I think that that would be an energizing choice. There's also people like Mark Warner or Tim Kaine, and so I think she's got quite a few people to choose from that have got good set of experience and would add to the ticket. But I like that Julian Castro.
Gretchen Whitmer, good luck in your new role as interim county prosecutor for Ingham County. That starts on Saturday, July 2nd, and we'll stay in touch.
All right. I look forward to it. Thank you.
And coming up on Current State, the National Executive Vice President for the AFL-CIO is coming to Flint this week to rally plumbers and others repairing the city's water lines. Coming up, Current State's Kevin Lavery spends time with three Lansing plumbers as they canvass the city, installing faucets and filters for free. That's coming up on Current State. People who attended Current State's most recent pop-up stories event enjoyed a first-person account of what it's like to run a downtown Lansing restaurant. Carol Edmonds launched and, for years, operated the Spotted Dog Cafe. At Scene Metro Space in East Lansing, she recently explained what led a novice to open a restaurant and also offered a look back at some of her most memorable customers.
In 1993, I was having coffee with a friend, and she mentioned to me that the cafeteria in the YWCA on Townsend Street in downtown Lansing had closed. By the time we finished our coffee, we had a plan to open a restaurant. Neither of us had been to culinary school, neither of us had ever owned a business. At that time, nobody served cappuccino in downtown, so we bought a cappuccino machine. In addition to the coffee, we served salads and soups and sandwiches, and we had a bakery case full of muffins and cookies and croissants that we baked. And on the very first day that we opened, as I turned on our neon sign and unlocked the door, I had this sudden worry that we were going to be a couple of croissant women in a donut town. Every day we had long lines, and after a couple of years, the Y told us that they were going to tear down the building, so we had to leave. So we found a spot on Washington Street, and we opened another restaurant called Spotted Dog Cafe. This past summer, after 20-plus years, we closed the Spotted Dog. We never became wealthy running the restaurant, but we were enriched in many ways by the people we met and the experiences we had. We, for a couple years, sponsored trick-or-treating downtown for dogs. And it raised money for the animal shelter and the dog park. You haven't lived until you've seen a couple of dogs in costumes bobbing for hot dogs. The people that came into the restaurant were lawyers, politicians, state workers, law professors from Cooley. We had a good assortment of people. And I realized there was a certain natural justice in the world one day when I looked out and I saw the Secretary of State at the back of a long line waiting for her lunch. Another day, the mayor of Lansing came in, ordered 5 lunches, and when he got to the register, realized he didn't have any money or a credit card on him. "I don't suppose there's such a thing as a free lunch," he said. "No," I told him, "there isn't. But you can come in and pay me tomorrow, but remember, I know where you work." Our employees were wonderful. They were creative, great people. Several of them were filmmakers. One woman won a prize for one of her films at a festival. Another was the co-founder of the Capital City Film Festival. And yet another actually filmed one of his films in the restaurant. We had several musicians, one of whom we allowed to keep his drum kit in the basement and gave him a key so he could practice at night and not bother anyone. We had one person who had a job later on in the White House for Michelle Obama. And then there was one young man who came in and said to me, "So, does it bother you that I have a nose stud?" And I said, "No, not really. I sort of figure by time that fashion hits Lansing, Michigan, it's kind of run its course." And by golly, if the nose stud didn't disappear. I actually was a little more fascinated by his tattoo, which I recognized as the cover art from the novel The Rule of the Bone by Russell Banks. And when I asked him about it, he said, "That book changed my life." He was a smooth talker, and he was someone that flirted a lot, and the ladies loved him. And in fact, one day, a woman going through a midlife crisis came in, took him out to see her new convertible, and drove off with him. We didn't see him for 2 days. Another day, he managed to get arrested on his break and spend the rest of the afternoon in jail. And now, he's finishing up work on his PhD. And like any business, we had our share of street people that came in. And the one that stands out most in my mind is a woman who used to pull all of her belongings in a suitcase on wheels behind her. She would come in and she would get a coffee. And then she would start speaking very loudly to people that nobody else could see. But if you went out and just spoke gently to her, she would calm down. And one day, as I was filling the bakery case with cake, she said seven words that first broke my heart and then gave me a lens through which I view all the people who are less fortunate or homeless or troubled. And what she said was, "I used to bake for my kids."
We invite you to tell a story at Current State's next pop-up stories event next week. We're gathering Wednesday the 25th at the Robin Theater in Rio Town, Lansing, for stories on the theme The Birds and the Bees. Join us and tell your own family-friendly story, or just join us to listen in. If you have a story, email us currentstate@wkar.org. You can also stay up to date on all of our upcoming events by liking our Facebook page, Pop-Up Stories Lansing. Coming up on Current State, our book reviewer Scott Southard returns with a tale of time, family, and fate. It all comes together in the novel Miller's Valley by Anne Quinlan. We'll get Scott's review and more after the break on Current State. You're listening to Current State on 90.5 WKAR. We also come your way every weekday at noon on AM 870, and we're always at WKAR.org. A new state report indicates that Flint residents coping with lead-tainted water could see their water bills double over the next 5 years. The study came just a day after Governor Snyder announced the state of Michigan would reimburse Flint residents for their water usage in May. Flint is in the midst of a massive waterline replacement project. Tomorrow, the National Executive Vice President of the AFL-CIO, Teferi Gabray, will meet with area plumbers and apprentices working in Flint. Current State's Kevin Lavery took a trip to Flint earlier this year. He spent a day with three plumbers from a Lansing labor union as they installed free faucets and filters in Flint.
It's my first reporting trip to Flint since the city's water crisis broke like a dam in the wake of one doctor's damning report. Even before I reach the plumbers and pipe fitters' local 370 Union Hall, I can see something big is shaping up. A cadre of Genesee County Sheriff's Patrol vehicles stands guard at the turnoff, their flashing lights guiding me and a stream of 400 volunteers into the parking lots. The circumstances that bring us all here are indeed tragic. And yet I'm struck by a brief moment of levity. Where else would you summon an army of plumbers to fight a lead contamination crisis in Flint? In a small suburb called Flushing. Inside, the place is buzzing. A massive mound of bottled water is stacked to one side. Nearby, local 370's Doug Del Duca inspects long rectangular boxes full of shiny chrome plumbing fixtures.
My fellow brothers are going ahead and they're checking out the faucets and making sure everything's good to go, and they're passing it to the people down the line and trying to keep the show on the road.
Any idea how many boxes you have of equipment?
Hundreds. It's hard to say. My guess would be 500, 600. It's tough to say.
What are you feeling today as you're seeing all your union brethren standing in line getting ready to hand out all this equipment and install it for people?
Oh, I'm overjoyed. Lots of pride. It's good to see lots of people coming out and trying to help the community today.
The task of installing hundreds of faucets and filters in Flint is orchestrated by Plumbing Manufacturers International, which coordinated the donated parts, and the United Association, the Plumbers and Pipefitters Union, simply known as UA. At 9 a.m., tradesmen from half a dozen Michigan UA locals converge in a meeting room for the day's briefing, and a word of caution from local 370's Ben Ranger.
Well, good morning, everybody. There's one little item that I want to stress. There's a lot of residents out here that are, you know, they're upset. And rightfully so, if you think about it. A lot of them don't understand who you are necessarily. They may misconstrue you for somebody from whoever they think that they blame the situation on, maybe the water department or the state or whatever. I can't stress enough that really, our only message today is that we're here to help.
The esprit de corps in the room is palpable, and the symbolism of the moment is not lost. This is to be a humanitarian mission led by a labor union in the city that gave birth to the nation's modern labor movement. Clearly, the crew is looking forward to rendering their service, but Ben Ranger is equally as clear that this temporary fix is by no means a long-term solution.
We're not telling them that it's safe to drink. You can tell them the same thing that everybody else is telling them, that the experts recommended these filters in the state. They're wanting to convert people from bottled water over to these filters. They want them, it's not sustainable to use bottled water all the time, so they want people to use these filters. There's also going to be test kits involved, and what they need to do is you can tell these people to get their water tested. That's what the city and the state has instructed them to do. So after these filters are installed, they still need to have their water tested.
More than anyone, the members of Local 370 know what they're about to see, because they're living it. Plumber Marcus Eubanks is raising 6 children in Flint.
I have 13, 7, 5, 3, 2, and a 3-month-old.
You've got your hands full.
Oh, yes. Never a dull moment in my house.
How are you coping?
It's not easy, but, you know, we got to maybe do what we have to do to not get so much, you know, affected by it. But yeah, for about maybe a year, a little bit over a year now, we've been drinking bottled water, even bathing our children in them. So, yeah, got to keep them tested and make sure their levels are down. So,
and are they doing okay?
Yes, they're doing quite well. Yeah, they're doing well. Thank God.
Yeah. The crews divide into small groups with their house assignments in hand. I ride along with 3 men from Local 333 based in Lansing: licensed plumber Corey Barrett, journeyman Christian Ben, and apprentice Ryan Sage. As we head out, Barrett tries to voice what all of us are thinking.
These kids are drinking and these people have been drinking, don't even know they've been drinking for this long. It's horrible. It's sad to see what's gonna happen.
What do you think is gonna happen, Corey, when we walk into the front door?
We're all hoping it's gonna be open arms, but I can also understand in a very distressed situation, you're gonna have very upset people, and you just try to, you know, ease the situation and try to remind them that we're there to help and it's not our fault. We're just trying to help.
House number 1. 4 men arrive, but only 3 perform their work. There's a difference sometimes in how a reporter is welcomed into a home versus a repairman. The lady of the house did not grant me permission to record, which was not unexpected. I must take my team at their word when they tell me they saw filthy water coming from the tap. House number 2. I'm welcomed in, and all of us get to work. Jesus and Deborah Rodriguez have lived in this World War II-era ranch house for 7 years. Jesus first noticed the problem with the water 2 years ago while watering his houseplants.
I have a filter, a spray bottle that I use for my plants, and it turns yellow, yellowish green. So I knew there was a problem. So then now I had to buy a machine that I really can't afford to run 5-gallon water so I can have water, because going to the fire department, I can't always go there to get water. And then I can't lift water anyways because I have a bad arm. So it's sort of a bad deal, because now I'm gonna have to probably save up some money and have somebody put a filter on my main water line coming in, because I don't want to keep taking a shower in here. I don't even give my dog's water from there.
The Rodriguez family is quickly watching their neighborhood depreciate. They love their home, and this is where they thought they would put down roots. I ask Jesus if he's willing to ride this crisis out.
I have to. I can't go. I can't sell my house if I wanted to. My plans, I bought this house to live here, to stay here, to grow up the rest of my life here. My daughter lives two blocks down, so we planned on living in this neighborhood. Now we can't even get out of the neighborhood because no one's going to buy or rent my home.
Then Jesus offers a view that seems to negate the now well-spun narrative of blame.
What is misunderstood about what's happening that's not getting out there in the media, or is being put out there incorrectly in your view?
Well, my view that they're not blaming the city. It's terrible that Flint's this way, and I blame the city, not the damn governor, the city, the mayor, all the councilmen. They're the ones that it's their responsibility. They're the ones that screwed us.
Flint's got a brand new mayor. She inherited this problem.
She inherited the problem, but the problem's still there. The commissioners and the mayor, they're the ones that knew all this was happening. Now look at everybody here in Flint. Now we're nationwide, the dirtiest water ever.
The Lansing plumbers have finished the job. The Rodriguez family has a new water filter in their kitchen, but it's cold comforts.
Well, I'm afraid to drink the water, even with that thing on there, and I think.
That's why I said I would put that on, run it through there, and take and have it tested to see what the results
Again?
Are.
Again?
Okay, yeah.
Before you drink out of it.
All right.
I'm not going to drink out of it.
More homes on our tour, some with small children, some with tap water residue you can see. By 2 o'clock, we're calling on Andrea Jones. She's caring for her elderly mother, whom she notes is holding up pretty well under the circumstances. Our unannounced house call is a pleasant surprise, and so is Andrea's attitude.
Well, it's not a good thing, but then that's life. Life is not a smooth road. This is just a bump in the road that we're going over, and this too will pass. That's it.
You have by far the best attitude of anyone I have interviewed yet about this, Andrea.
Well, you know, it's not that we like it, but if you can't do anything about it, don't worry about it. Ain't no sense of everybody dying, and I don't plan on having a stroke. So I do what I can do, and what I can't do, I don't worry about it. Pray about it and move on.
Inspecting the faucet, Corey Barrett comes across a snag.
Whoever installed this, it broke the faucet. It's a brand new faucet.
Really?
Yes, sir. It's leaking unfiltered water around the filter.
Complete overhaul, then.
Yep.
Faucet repaired. Filter installed. Connections are made. Mechanical and human.
There you go, dear.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We say goodbye and head back to the Union Hall for more parts. This is where I part company with the men of UA Local 333. In his moment of downtime, Christian Ben reflects on his day in Flint, and it somehow mirrors his own life in Lansing.
I have a special needs son at home. So if I can help, you know, with all these kids and how this lead is affecting kids, I don't know the long outcome on what it's going to do. But if I can help, you know, anybody just with a little bit to not go through some of the stress and things I've went through dealing with brain injury and stuff like that, you know, I'm happy.
So maybe you've seen a little bit of your own child in some of these kids' faces?
Yeah, I have, actually. My child, my grandkids. That's what I was looking at. You know, one little girl, I was looking at her, reminding her me of my granddaughter, and I was showing her pictures on my phone and stuff like that. And it was real cool to be out in the community and just helping out.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
And I'm Mark Bayshore. Time has a way of slipping away from us, and we often feel that sensation when we're immersed in a good book. That's the way Current State book reviewer Scott Southard feels about Miller's Valley by Anne Quinlan.
There are many characters in Anne Quinlan's very American family epic, Miller's Valley, but the most important is probably time itself. Everyone, including the valley where the novel takes place, seems to be trapped in an hourglass, with the sand slowly falling away until there is nothing left. At the heart of Miller's Valley is Mimi Miller, who is the story's narrator. We meet her when she is young and high-spirited. She is smart, creative, and has a knack for saying things that might get her in trouble. This is her world, and she is seen as royalty by the community. The valley is known as Miller's Valley because of the history and power of her family's farm. While the farm is not as successful now as it was for her ancestors, everyone still remembers. Some are bitter about their influence, others are accepting. We watch Mimi age, starting at 10 years old and ending when she is in her 60s. There are friendships that come and go, good relationships, and, of course, bad ones as well. We cheer the good decisions she makes in her life and squirm over some of the more tragic ones. The story begins in the 1960s, and time is starting to run out for the valley and its inhabitants. It floods often, and the government wants to purchase all the land so they can build a dam. Doing so would erase the only world that Mimi and her family have ever known. The residents fight against the takeover and try to go on living as if time isn't against them and everything they hold dear. One of the brilliant aspects of Quinlan's novel is the depths of the characters surrounding Mimi. Each has a distinct voice that jumps right off the page. From her eccentric Aunt Ruth, who refuses to leave her small home, to her brother Tommy, a charismatic soul that changes after returning from the Vietnam War. Each character is full of life. After finishing this book, my thoughts kept returning to Mimi's mother. She is a nurse and very much the realist in the family. She is the rock for all the Millers and does her best to hold everything together. We rarely see her breakdown, but when she does, it's that much more powerful. When Miller's Valley comes to its emotional end, it's hard to leave behind Mimi and the other characters, but say goodbye we must. Luckily, Quinlan's masterful writing gives us the chance to watch the story slip away, like sand in an hourglass, one grain at a time. If only our own endings could be told so brilliantly. For Current State, this is Scott Southard.
Scott Southard is the author of the novels Permanent Spring Showers and A Jane Austen Daydream. You can follow his writing via his blog, The Musings and Artful Blunders of Scott D. Southard, at sdsouthard.com. Well, the Big Ten softball tournament offers another chance for underperforming teams to turn heads and possibly earn an NCAA tournament bid. This year, the MSU softball team qualified for the conference tourney for the first time since 2014, but fell to Illinois in the first round. The loss ended all NCAA tourney hopes for the team. It's a contrast with recent seasons. Last year, the team finished second in the College World Series. Al Martin, host of WKAR's Current Sports, joins us now. Not exactly the best weekend for softball either, at least here in East Lansing.
But very tough. Mark, how you doing?
Softball or golfing or anything like that with the snow we had yesterday.
Right, exactly.
Crazy. Well, MSU led throughout much of that opening round game against Illinois. Then the seventh inning happened, and just about everything went south. What happened?
Yeah, well, you know, errors. That's what happened, Mark. And if you look at that game, I mean, Michigan State commits two errors in the seventh inning, allowing number seven Illinois to rally for a 3-2 win. Pitcher Christina Zalewski, she was absolutely fantastic, Mark, and has been throughout much of the year. In that game, Mark, she allowed just three hits through the first six innings. Absolutely lights out. And then the seventh inning happens. You know, they give up a leadoff single. That runner then moved on to second base on a sacrifice bunt. Then another single. Then another one. And then Michigan State first baseman Sarah Gutnick, she committed her second error of the game, allowing Jill Nicholas to score. And then second baseman Destiny Luna mishandled a grounder to bring in the winning run. And it's interesting, though, when you look at this matchup between Michigan State and Illinois in that first round, Mark, throughout the weekend, Michigan State did not see Illinois, though, due to a scheduling quirk in recent years, dating back to 2013. So when you have a squad, going against a squad in the postseason with a lot on the line, again, Michigan State needed to go all the way and win the Big Ten Tourney Championship in order to accrue an NCAA bid. That's a lot on the line and a lot of pressure when you're facing a team that you haven't seen in more than 2 years. Mm.
The team finishes one game below 500 for the year. How is Jackie Joseph and her squad looking back at this season?
Definitely successful, without a doubt, Mark. When you look at this squad this season, they are coming off an offseason of drama, if you remember, where, and I got a chance to chat briefly with Jackie about this not too long ago, about the offseason drama that occurred between the program and Alyssa McBride. Yes. And where Alyssa McBride, former Michigan State softball player, accused the program of trying to intentionally hit her during batting practice one day. There was a lot of drama. Of course, that investigation panned out. There was no wrongdoing found on the part of the Michigan State softball coaching staff. So you have all this drama going into this year. And then what happens? This squad goes back to the Big Ten tourney for the first time since 2014. They're back in the Big Ten tourney for just the third time in the past eight seasons. They finished just, what, one game in back of getting to that 500 mark of maybe 28-28. If they did have a solid weekend, we could have been talking about the first winning season for this squad since 2007. The pitching staff, how about the pitching staff? Other than Zalewski, I mean, they were stacked this entire year, Mark. They actually were ranked fourth in the conference and 21st nationally, and they just lose three players and one starter going into next year. This is a very young team with endless potential, Mark.
So one game below 500, you can still call it a success.
Without, in comparison to recent years, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Minnesota broke Michigan's 19-game winning streak during the tournament championship game this weekend. Did that hurt Michigan in the seeding for the NCAA tournament?
I think it did. It did, but not a lot. I mean, you're grasping at straws here when you talk about being a number one seed or a number two seed. Both are still pretty good. So I think if Michigan would have won yet another Big Ten tournament championship, they would have been a number one seed going to the NCAA tourney. I think the committee looked at it and said, okay, Michigan falls just short. They're riding a 19-game win streak into that game as well. Minnesota nipped them. Give them a number two. That's still very, very good, Mark. So they'll play Valparaiso on Friday, and if they get past that game, they'll play the winner of Notre Dame and Miami of Ohio. So, and they will also, you know, this will take place. This region of the bracket will take place right in their backyard. They will host the Ann Arbor Regional at Alumni Field. It's the third time in 4 years that they've actually hosted it opening round.
32-year Michigan head coach Carol Hutchins is a force in Division I softball. What accounts for her success?
Well, when you talk about being a force, Mark, I think even that statement is an understatement. She is the winningest softball coach in Division I history. It's unbelievable. She accomplished that feat early April of this year. And, you know, it's so crazy because we actually had Carol on Current Sports last week. And she talked about, you know, I asked her, I mean, what does that mean to you, being the winningest coach in D1 softball history? And just like all the greats do, they say, you know, it's nice and all, but, hey, it's all about championships. It's all about looking toward the next challenge. And when you look at what she's built throughout her 32-year history with this program, Mark, it is really remarkable. And I always look at how she coaches the young women that come through her program. She's very laid back. She's very relatable. But at the same time, she's very intense and competitive. And, you know, the players who come through our program, they want to win for her. It's such an interesting relationship that she garners with the, you know, the individuals who come through her program. And also, you know, she does have ties right here to Michigan at Michigan State, Mark. She played basketball and softball right here at Michigan State. She is an alum.
Player too.
A basketball player as well. And she got her degree from here. She played, I believe, 3 years here at Michigan State, basketball and softball back in the 70s. So we also chatted about, you know, how it's kind of a catch-22 with her being a longtime head coach out at U of M, but also having ties right here.
Shifting gears, the NBA draft happens June 23rd in New York. Former MSU men's basketball player Denzel Valentine hopes to hear his name called. But before he steps onto an NBA floor, he will have already tested his game against some of the league's best. Tell us about Denzel's good fortune here.
This is unbelievably cool, Mark. I mean, to see this young man, you know, bred right here in Lansing, from Lansing Sexton to now, you know, going to the NBA for sure. But again, it was announced over the weekend that he has now been chosen for the USA basketball select team. Now, the select team scrimmages and trains against Team USA in the weeks leading up to the Olympics in Rio de Janeiro. Mm. How cool is that? And if you remember another local tie, Draymond Green, former Michigan State hoop great here, he was on the 2014 select team in preparation for the 2014 FIBA World Basketball Cup. And he is now, Draymond, is a finalist to make the roster for the Olympic team this year. It just shows you how many strides he's taken throughout his basketball career as well, Mark.
We got less than a minute, Al. Summarize where you think the Tigers are at right now. We pulled out a win yesterday, but by and large, I watched a few games last week. By and large, the Tigers seem to be struggling. Overall, what do you think?
Bad. It's just a bad team right now, Mark. I got to call it like it is. You know, and everyone's calling for the head of Brad Ausmus right now because this team has not performed up to the level of expectation. It's so early in the baseball season to make hard assumptions like that. But they've got a lot of holes in the boat right now, Mark.
Al Martin, host of WKAR's Current Sports. You hear it weekdays at 1 p.m. on AM 870 WKAR. He's also the host of Current Sports on TV. WKAR-TV airs every Thursday night at 10:30. More on college softball and the Tigers later today. Thank you, Al. Have a great day.
You too. Thank you, Mark.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, an MSU entomologist says the chances of a Michigan resident contracting the Zika virus is extremely low. We'll hear more from MSU entomology professor Michael Kaufman. Plus, he won 2 Tony Awards for writing the musical version of The Bridges of Madison County. We speak with composer Jason Robert Brown about that musical, which opens at the Wharton Center later this week. That and more Tuesday on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Kevin Lavery directed the program today. Thanks as well to Scott Pohl, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, and to Drew Hill. The Current State podcast is your informative, insightful, and indispensable connection with what's happening around mid-Michigan and beyond. From politics to education, environmental news to healthcare, science and tech to music and theater, stories from around the state in your hometown, the Current State podcast at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Have a great day. We hope you can join us on Tuesday. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's Current State.